information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
To border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Lied to
by the government. They were innocent and they have no idea what they're up against.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 58 of Media Monarchy, coming to you live January 11th, 2008 from the Portland Radio Authority and from the Revere Radio Network. Tons of news to go over this week, everything from Danny Casolaro and Philip Agee. We got HARP and Navy Sonar. We got tasers and bioweapon sensors, Kitty Biometrics, Big Pharma, drones for the 2012 Olympics, the Afghana surge. We got the Straits of Hormuz and the Gulf of Tonkin, false flags then and now. Stakes is high with Bush in Israel, the plunge protection team, Goldman banksters, all the latest on Ron Paul and all the warmongers like McCain and Hillary. We got Outside the Box with Alec Ansari, the Simpsons campaign parody, more on Charlie Wilson, Will Smith and Scientology, and even our man Morrissey, all on episode 58 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network.
We come, why we go? So why then do I know? I will see you. I will see you in far off places. Knows why I grieve, and yes, one day I will close my eyes forever, but I will see you. To sit together, but it's so hard for our hearts to combine. And for some is to save lives, but destiny for some is to end lives, but there is no end, and I will see you in far off places. God bestows protection upon you, and if the USA doesn't
right, my friends. That was Morrissey. I will see you in far off places. And he might see you in far off places, and we'll get to that in just a second. But first, let me formally welcome you to episode 58 of Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live January 11th, 2008, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. And you can, of course, hit me up on all the Web 2.0 portals, MySpace and Facebook and Dig and YouTube and all that. You can send me email, MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com, and the podcast available anytime thanks to RadioForAll.net and Archive.org. British singer wants to perform in Iran. This coming from Press TV, which is, of course, basically the Iranian mouthpiece. I find that I post a lot of news from Press TV because I think it's important on some level to always get the other side. So, controversial British singer Stephen Patrick Morrissey has announced his intention to perform in Iran alongside a number of local artists. The 48-year-old vocalist is currently in negotiation with Iranian officials to appear at a concert in Iran during his Middle East tour in 2008. Morrissey's management is awaiting a formal response from Iran's Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance on the matter. The performance, which is slated for June, will hopefully feature Arab pop star Kazim El Sahir. Morrissey has always been politically outspoken, criticizing the British royal family, former British Prime Ministers Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, and U.S. President George W. Bush. Now, speaking of Kazim El Sahir, he is a famous Arab pop singer, songwriter, and musician. He's established himself as one of the most successful singers in the Arab world, having sold more than 30 million albums since the start of his career, ranging from big romantic ballads to more political work, from pop to Arab classical. He's covered the spectrum of music with a kind of success not seen since the heyday of Kalthum. And he's the son of a palace worker and has 9 siblings and a link up. You can read more about him. I, of course, had never heard anything about him. This is in the 2+ years since I've been doing MediaMonarchy.com. I believe the third time I've been able to mention, third time I've been able to mention Morrissey on MediaMonarchy.com. One of the previous ones, coming from True to You, one of the Morrissey, many Morrissey fan sites, and also a site called Aversion, where Morrissey basically said Los Angeles was a police state. This going way back on MediaMonarchy.com to January 8th, 2006. Morrissey has no love for LA's police force. In an online interview conducted by True to You, Morrissey revealed that although he had made, he has since moved to Rome, although he had made Los Angeles his surrogate home in the States, he's a little uneasy around the town's police force. Quote, as stunningly beautiful as Los Angeles is, it is also essentially a police state. Also have linked up on Morrissey's Wikipedia entry, if you jump down to views on political leaders. Morrissey has always been politically outspoken, and the figures he has criticized... Oh, wow, that's funny. Press TV basically yanked this, because we just mentioned the British royal family, Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, and George Bush. Morrissey's first solo album, Viva Hate, from 88, included a track entitled Margaret on the Guillotine, a tongue-in-cheek jab at Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. British police responded by searching Morrissey's home and carrying out an official investigation, while Simon Reynolds, who had interviewed Morrissey for Melody Maker, was even questioned about the tone in which Morrissey had made certain remarks about Thatcher. It's been said that many of the officers were embarrassed at the absurdity of the situation, some even asking for Morrissey's autograph. In October 2004, Morrissey released a statement urging American voters to vote for John Kerry for president, saying, quote, with all my heart, I urge people to vote against George Bush. John Stewart would be ideal, but John Kerry is the logical and sane move. It does not need to be said yet again, but Bush has single-handedly turned the U.S. into the most neurotic and terror-obsessed country on the planet. For non-Americans, the United States is suddenly not a very nice place to visit because U.S. immigration officers, under the rules of Bush, now conduct themselves with all the charm and unanswerable indignation of Hitler's SS. Please bring sanity and intelligence back to the United States. Don't forget to vote. Vote for John Kerry and get rid of George Bush. And what did that get him? In February 2006, Morrissey said he had been interviewed by the FBI and by the British intelligence. After having spoke out against the American and British governments, Morrissey said, "The FBI and the special branch have investigated me, and I've been interviewed and taped and so forth. They were trying to determine if I was a threat to the government. It didn't take them long to realize that I am not." And lastly, a controversial etching on the 12-inch vinyl release of Strange Ways Here We Come, the last Smiths album, said, quote, "Guy Fawkes was a genius." Guy Fawkes being, of course, infamous for the 1605 gunpowder plot to blow up Parliament. Remember, remember the 5th of November. Now, there was a quick mention of Will Smith and Scientology. Now, while he won't come out and actually say that he's joined the Church of Scientology, New York Daily News has a report that at the recent wrap for, I believe it's called Hudson, a film that Will Smith has coming out later in the year, maybe next year, his wrap present, which is traditional for the big Hollywood stars to give gifts for everyone. What was Will Smith's gift for everyone? Was a gift card for a free personality test at the Church of Scientology, which of course is ridiculous because they give those things for free. So thanks, Will Smith. And that's all up there on MediaMonarchy.com, of course, the things you can click through and read about Xenu and the hydrogen bombs hidden in volcanoes and all the ridiculous things of the celebrity cult of Scientology, Xenu.net, Xenu.net. Now, I hit on it a couple weeks ago when the film was first coming out, but I saw the film just a few days ago, Charlie Wilson's War, and I was highly disappointed. It wasn't very good. Mike Nichols, I was a little harsh. I got home and was ranting and raving about the film, and my girlfriend's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, calm down. Mike Nichols isn't a hack." But the film isn't very good. It's not very slick propaganda. There's nothing cinematically interesting about it. There's a couple really good scenes. Probably the best scene is with Tom Hanks and Philip Seymour Hoffman when Philip Seymour Hoffman, the CIA agent who helps Charlie Wilson funnel funds to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, which of course led to 9/11 and all that, which we went over. There's a couple new articles about Charlie Wilson's War. Now, I believe it was two episodes that we went over. Charlie Wilson's War helped to give us 9/11. But there's a new good one from Chalmers Johnson, posted up on ZMag.org. "Imperialist Propaganda: Second Thoughts on Charlie Wilson's War." Chalmers Johnson writes, "I have some personal knowledge of congressmen like Charlie Wilson because for close to 20 years, my representative in the 50th Congressional District of California was Republican Randy Duke Cunningham, now serving, of course, an 8.5-year prison sentence for soliciting and receiving bribes from defense contractors. Wilson and Cunningham held exactly the same plummy committee assignments in the House of Representatives, the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, plus the Intelligence Oversight Committee, there from which they could dole out large sums of public money with little or no input from their colleagues or constituents. Both men flagrantly abused their positions, but with radically different consequences. Cunningham went to jail because he was too stupid to know how to game the system, retire, and become a lobbyist, whereas Wilson received the CIA Clandestine Services' first Honored Colleague Award ever given to an outsider and went on to become a $360,000 per annum lobbyist for Pakistan. In a secret testimony at CIA headquarters on June 9, 1993, James Woolsey, Bill Clinton's first DCI and one of the agency's least competent chiefs in its checkered history, said, "The defeat and breakup of the Soviet Empire is one of the great events of world history. There were many heroes in this battle, but to Charlie Wilson must go a special recognition. One important part of that recognition, studiously avoided by the CIA and most subsequent American writers on the subject, is that Wilson's activities in Afghanistan led directly to a chain of blowback that culminated in the attacks of September 11th and led to the United States' current status as the most hated nation on Earth." Now, the article is kind of long. We're going to jump down to the last section with the header, "An Imperialist Comedy," which brings us back to the movie and its reception here, mentioning, of course, that it's been banned in Afghanistan. "One of the severe side effects of imperialism in its advanced stages seems to be that it rots the brains of the imperialists. They start believing that they are the bearers of civilization, the bringers of light to primitives and savages, the carriers of science and modernity to backward peoples, beacons and guides for citizens in the underdeveloped world. Such attitudes are normally accompanied by racist ideology that proclaims the intrinsic superiority and right to rule of white Caucasians. Innumerable European colonialists saw the hand of God in Darwin's discovery of evolution, so long as it was understood that he had programmed the outcome of evolution in favor of late Victorian Englishmen. Jumping down, when imperialist activities produce unmentionable outcomes, such as those well known to anyone paying attention to Afghanistan since about 1990, then ideological thinking kicks in. The horror story is suppressed or reinterpreted as something benign or ridiculous, like a comedy, or simply curtailed before the denouement becomes obvious. Thus, for example, Melissa Roddy, a Los Angeles filmmaker with inside information from the Charlie Wilson production team, notes, with a link, that the film's happy ending came about because Tom Hanks, a co-producer as well as the leading actor, quote, just can't deal with this 9/11 thing. Similarly, we are told by another insider reviewer, James Rocky, R-O-C-C-H-I, that the scenario, as originally written by Aaron Sorkin of West Wing fame, included the following line for CIA agent Philip Seymour Hoffman, quote, remember I said this, there's going to be a day when we're going to look back and say, I'd give anything if Afghanistan were overrun with godless communists. This line is, of course, nowhere to be found in the film. Now, with the mention of racism, this was one of the things that jumped out at me in the film. Charlie Wilson and his aide go to Pakistan and see some of the ghettos and tent villages set up by Afghani refugees, and they're, of course, touched by what they see, and on the flight back, you realize it's sort of that changing moment when he realizes he's going to do something about it. And he tells this story about being a little kid where the mean neighbor killed his dog. So he burnt down his flower patch. But that wasn't very satisfying to him. This guy, this mean Mr. Neighbor, was a city councilman. So when the next election rolled around, Charlie Wilson decided to go into the black neighborhoods and drive those people to the polls, people who had probably never voted before. And while he took them there and dropped them off, he would throw out this last comment, hey, I don't want to influence you too much, but Mr. Hazard killed my dog. And he realized at that moment that that's why he loved America, and that he could make a difference. And it struck me as I almost finished the line for him in my head while I was sitting in the theater. I almost yelled at the screen and said, you know, after I took all these black people to the polls, that's when I realized that I could manipulate brown people into doing what I want. They don't say that in the film, but that's of course what it means. So that's the same thing that Charlie Wilson's war did. It's manipulating brown people into the ends that the white people want. And of course, consequences be damned. But I won't belabor that point anymore. The film also makes funny mentions of John Murtha, Rudolph Giuliani, and there's even a point where they mention that Zia, then head of Pakistan, he didn't kill Bhutto. And that struck me because we, of course, know that Benazir Bhutto was just assassinated a few weeks ago, but in this film, they mention that, of course, her father was also assassinated, possibly by Zia. And, of course, Benazir Bhutto was possibly assassinated by Musharraf. Jumping on, though, there's another article, Reagan's Bargain, Charlie Wilson's War. That one's up on Consortium News. That one's all about nuclear blackout and Bhutto's murder and nuclear politics. There's another one up on Larry Johnson's great blog, NoQuarterUSA.net. Larry Johnson, of course, ex-CIA agent and talking head on all the Air America and MSNBC-type stations. He's got more on Charlie Wilson's war, where I'll just read the intro to it. He says he received a lot of back-channel emails from several friends, like retired military and intelligence officers who knew Charlie Wilson who worked on the Afghan task force. Folks have different views and thoughts, and so what follows is a great piece of all of his spook friends talking about what really went down. And then finally, from Mark Crispin Miller, News from the Underground, he also has some hard truth about Charlie Wilson's war. They're all linked up for you. I'm not going to go through anymore because they all basically mention what I mentioned a couple weeks ago about Charlie Wilson's war, is it helped give us 9/11. Moving on, there's an interesting old advertisement. I believe it's from 1979, when the Pakistan International Airlines introduced its new flight service to New York City. Now, this is posted up under 9/11 preview, coming once again thanks to the Danger Room blog on Wired.com. There's a big photo, and it shows the World Trade Center towers really big, and it has this silhouette of a plane, which is obviously, if you look at the silhouette and think of it as the mirror image, the plane is heading directly towards the World Trade Center. So there's a nice big ad for you to look at that, nice big, beautiful black and white ad from 1979. Moving on, and as long as we're staying, I'll tell you right now, we're getting all this sort of lighter pop culture stuff out of the way. We're going to get into the dirtier stuff as we progress into this episode. But one last bit of pop culture-ness for you. This coming from the Boston Globe. No one spared in the Simpsons campaign parody. Now, for those political junkies watching the Republican presidential debate on Fox News Channel or otherwise occupied last Sunday night, you missed a hilarious Simpsons send-up of a campaign that made fun of candidates, the political parties, New Hampshire voters, the media, and just about everyone else.
And Ralph is only 8 years old. It says in the Constitution you have to be 35.
The Constitution? I'm pretty sure the Patriot Act killed it to ensure our freedoms.
Ooh, the Patriot Act is so terrible. The government might find out what library books I take out.
What's next, finding out what operas I go to?
Our top story, President Ralph Wiggum. 2 days ago, this bedwetter made a splash in the Springfield primary. With the remaining 49 primaries scheduled for next Tuesday, can Ralph go from Sesame Street to Pennsylvania Avenue, Adriatica Bell Johnson?
Van Nash, Ralph Wiggum is a breath of fresh air for a country hungry for a change of air. And he's already a master of the soundbite, from his take on immigration reform,
stranger danger,
to his disciplined stance on government spending.
I only have this much monies.
Well, I'd hate to be the fingernail in this Cobb salad, but we don't even know if this young man is a Democrat or Republican. Now, before we invite Ralph to the prom, we should find out if he's wearing a tux or a tutu.
This meeting of the Democratic Party will come to order, babies. So if we nominate this Ralph Wiggum, we will be like an unstoppable choo-choo. I already got my assless sparkle tux clean for the inauguration.
I agree with my ex-husband. With Ralph on the ticket, I don't know how we will blow it, but we will, because that's what the Democratic Party is all about.
Yes! Right on.
Ralph! Ralph! Ralph!
Ralph, darling, be a Democrat. They have Alec Baldwin. They have Stephen Baldwin. They might as well not even have a Baldwin.
Leave him alone, you vultures.
Who are you?
Ralph and I used to date.
Nice. Now maybe you can help him pick a party.
Ralph, they have no right to do this to you. They just want to use you.
Maybe I want to use them.
Maybe you want?
Use them to make this country great again. When we're mad, we'll just use our words. Then the rest of the world will play nice with us, and the only boom-booms will be in our pants.
Maybe you wouldn't be such a bad president.
And you can be my first ladle.
I like the sound of that.
Ralph! 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 Ralph!
The following is a paid political announcement by the Republican and Democratic parties. Compassionate. Tough. These are all words Ralph Wiggum doesn't know, but he doesn't need to know them. He lives them every day.
I'm voting Ralph for president. His easy smile makes me think everything is okay, even when I know it ain't.
I'm voting for Ralph, too, but don't tell you know who.
On November 4th, vote for the latest in a long line of great American leaders.
I want a tricycle and a dog who won't chew my Hot Wheels.
So that's a little clip from the most recent Simpsons episode, E Pluribus Wiggum, where, of course, they skewer everybody from Arianna Huffington and George Will and Rush Limbaugh and more and more and more. And so that's a little bit of the Simpsons for you. Moving on to my man Alex Ansari, Outside the Box, every week on Portland Community Media, and he, of course, posts those episodes up on Google Video, and I always post them up for you on MediaMonarchy.com. The latest episode is Outside the Box 134. Alex reports on the recent assassination in Pakistan and the evidence that indicates a multi-government cover-up into who is behind the killing. Later, he talks about the importance of building up the spirit within as we face monumental challenges in our world and lives. There's also a video posted up, a little bonus clip. Alex made it on CBS News 6, Coin, out of Portland. That's up on Google Video, or rather YouTube. And finally, Alex also has his show every Saturday on We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com.
I got a couple other headlines that we'll talk about tonight. Crude oil hits $100 a barrel, record high. U.S. manufacturing fails to grow. Japan to increase emergency stockpiles of grains. Coming soon, microwave gun that can destroy your car from 600 feet away. FBI to use digital billboard alerts. Mexico to microchip Central American migrants. It's going to be a very, very strange year in the 2008 year that we have ahead, in 2009 and 2010. In all the years leading up to 2012 and beyond. We'll be back in just a bit. Here's a quick clip from CBS News 6 just a couple days ago. Somebody emailed me briefly about a Ron Paul event that was going to be taking place at 1 p.m. Tuesday at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Showed up with my bullhorn, and we ended up making the Channel 6 News. We'll be back.
And here in Portland, the Ron Paul revolution swept downtown today. About 20 supporters lined the streets in downtown to convince voters to give Paul a second look. Ron Paul is running on the Republican ticket, but he has many radical and progressive ideas, mostly based on being extremely fiscally conservative.
Today, things are completely reckless. I think there's a lot of money laundering going on. There's a lot of corruption. And unless we do a major turnaround and have someone in that's actually not bought off, does it have those interests, you know, we're not going to survive as a country.
Ron Paul's grassroots campaign, very strong online, and it's helped him gain more of a national spotlight. A reminder, the Iowa caucus Thursday. Keep it right here on Coin News 6 for the latest development.
Sure. Yeah, Coin 6 will tell you what's going on. You know, they were talking about this oil situation, how it's now over $100 a barrel, and they were going through all the candidates, and I just guess in my mind, well, they'll go with four Republicans, all packaged, and four Democrats, and Ron Paul won't be involved in that, nor will Kucinich, nor will Gravel. And exactly as I just guessed as I was watching CNN today while I was walking through Pizza Schmied's, grabbing something to eat real quick at lunch, I was looking up, and there it was, four Republicans, four Democrats, talking about invested in nuclear energy and a bunch of other phony solutions to surface-level problems. Crude oil hits $100 a barrel, record high, reaching that milestone amid an unshakable view that global demand for oil and petroleum products will outstrip supplies. So we talked about the higher costs in grains, the higher costs of foods, and it's happening and it's here.
Yeah, it's true. I was just at work last night, and there they were, like a couple of hens in a hen house, talking about Britney Spears and her latest breakdown. And I felt like looking at a couple monkeys in a zoo. I really wasn't sure. Just kind of watching, like, the dumbed-down effect take place after whatever the hell they drank from the water. Okay, bad joke. I drank from the water. That's just the thing. We were talking about Britney Spears, and I just start pausing, like, wait, I'm in this reality. I'm here. And all this stuff's going on, and we know about the economy collapsing. We know about the food shortages. We know about all of this stuff. And Britney Spears is still hot. Britney Spears is still the top topic. I go to the supermarket, and I see all the stuff with Jenna and Brad Pitt, and I look away, and I turn around, and there's another magazine, and there's Brad Pitt again, and I run away. I might run 10 feet away, screaming at the top of my lungs, get away! Get away! And then I run right in, smack, trip over, like, GMO fruit roll-ups, hit my head on some Coca-Cola cans, and find myself laying on a whole stack of Brad Pitt magazines. Oh, man, it's horrible. It's horrible. It's like, there's nothing like the feeling of hearing R.E.M.'s It's the End of the World as We Know It, while walking through a Safeway or walking through your modern grocery store, which to me is like an active laboratory, like real, you know, rats, like, ooh, let's see, like, you know, how we can fuck the humans up today. No, I don't know what's going on in supermarkets anymore.
Now, of course, Alex Ansari should not be saying the F word on his radio show. He kind of screwed up, but thought that was a pertinent clip to play for you, which dovetails right into all the latest on the Ron Paul revolution. So much in the last week, because I know last week we went over the Iowa caucus. This week, we had the New Hampshire primary, as well as last night, the South Carolina debate. So there's so much. I'm going to go in chronological order. So we're going to start back with last Saturday, January 5th. Ron Paul was on Bill Moyer's Journal to discuss the current election season and how his presidential campaign is going. So that video is up thanks to Raw Story and their new video site, Raw Replay. Ron Paul also went on Jay Leno. And interestingly enough, when I got into the studio here at the Portland Radio Authority, somebody's got up on the desktop two PDFs of the full transcript of Ron Paul on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. So that was good to see that I came into PRA and somebody's talking about Ron Paul. Thank God. So we're going to have that clip. We also have a link up on Gambling 911. Leno frustrated with Fox over the Ron Paul exclusion, which of course they tried to, and they did, exclude him from a forum, but then had to turn around and include him in last night's South Carolina debate because they got mad protests. They had to roll over. We also had Ron Paul on CNN's Late Edition on January 6th and posted up along with that. I'll just mention to you a little brief overview of Congressman Paul's record. He's never voted to raise taxes, never voted for an unbalanced budget, never voted for a federal restriction on gun ownership, never voted to raise congressional pay, has never taken a government-paid junket, has never voted to increase the power of the executive branch. He voted against the Patriot Act. He voted against regulating the internet. He voted against the Iraq War. Finally, from Illuminated, which is a channel up on YouTube, they've got the clip of Howard Stern gushing about Ron Paul. So here's our first little bit of the Ron Paul revolution.
In politics, it's usually the insurgent who carries the discontent of people who feel excluded from the mainstream. This campaign, Ron Paul is the insurgent. Congressman Ron Paul from Texas placed fifth in Iowa with 10% of the vote. But turn on your computer and you'll find him at the top of the world's most watched video posting site.
Congressman Paul, it's nice to meet
Hi.
You. My name is Steve Grubb. I'm from over at YouTube, News and Politics Center over there.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, welcome. You have quite the following on YouTube. We're excited you could...
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. More subscribers than any other candidate on the platform.
Some 7 million viewers at last count have clicked on Ron Paul's YouTube offerings. More viewers than tuned in to the first two Republican debates on cable television. Whatever happens now, this libertarian Republican has become a phenomenon in his own right, taking on the powers that be in his party to argue against the war in Iraq, among other contrarian positions.
Well, we have a major task. When you think about returning this country to the Constitution, we have drifted from the Constitution in the past 100 years. The Congress ignores it, the courts ignore it, the executive branch ignores it. But there's a large number of dedicated Americans who believe that America was a great country when we obeyed the Constitution, that liberty was more important than largesse and special interest government. This is a major undertaking to take on the military-industrial complex, the medical-industrial complex, and all the special interests by individuals sending in money. So I think we've done a tremendous job, but we also know what we're doing. We're not tinkering with the system. We're not talking about mismanaging the war in Iraq. We're talking about the change in foreign policy that was established by Woodrow Wilson, our pretense that we're able to make the world safe for democracy and forever spend ourselves into oblivion. I mean, this is a major undertaking, but the revolution toward this goal has actually begun, and how far we go in the campaign, we don't know, but I'll tell you what, the American people, and there's this large segment sending the money to our campaign that are determined that this revolutionary spirit will continue.
Ron Paul, thanks very much for joining us. Good luck.
I still think Rudy is the best candidate for the Republican Party.
He seems to be wilting.
Ron Paul.
I don't know if he really wants it. Ron Paul. I got to tell you about this guy, Ron Paul. He's fantastic. The Republicans, for some reason, they laugh at him all the time. But meanwhile, he did pretty good in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, he's a Republican. And he says, listen, I become president, I'm taking us out of Iraq. I'm taking us out of everywhere in the world. He goes, what good has it done us being in these fucking Middle Eastern countries?
They all hate us.
He goes, they hate us. I'm taking us out of all these wars, and we're done. He goes, and I'm not an isolationist. I'm not afraid to use the military where it's needed. But he said, to sit in here in these extended fucking wars, drain the economy. And he goes, and if we stay or we leave, the same goddamn thing happens. Nothing. So let's leave. And people love this guy when he talks. He makes sense.
Well, where are the votes?
Well, he's Romney.
Who
right
is he, Howard?
I don't know who this guy is.
Is he a governor?
I heard him speak.
Paul, he's a congressman from Texas.
Okay. I heard him speak, and I said, this guy should be getting more airtime.
Well, let me ask you, now here's something. Here's something interesting. I found out about this sort of on my own. We went, hey, where's Ron Paul? And then we made some phone calls. You weren't. I saw you interviewed with Wolf Blitzer on CNN. It wasn't mentioned. I don't think, and I don't want to be unfair, I didn't see it on MSNBC or any of the other cable channels. I mean, it seems like a big story. One of the major candidates, or certainly major in terms of you have as much prestige as anybody else in fundraising, is left out. Why was this not a story?
You know, I don't know. I can speculate. If I qualified, as you point out, that I had the qualification, it must be they didn't want to hear the message. Maybe they're intimidated. Maybe they're frightened. Maybe they don't want to hear the truth. Who knows? We'll have to figure that out.
Okay. I mean, what do? Do you call Fox News at this point and go, I want to know why I was excluded? I mean,
yeah,
you seem like a gentleman. You don't seem like that guy. But it seems like you should be kicking somebody's ass right now. You're being extremely polite for something I think you got screwed over quite. You know, I mean, I might not necessarily agree with you, but I think as an American, we like to see everybody get an equal shot, especially someone who deserves an equal shot. And it seems like,
and the American people believe that way, too. And I think you've tapped into the sentiment of what America thinks.
Now, sandwiched in here on our Ron Paul Revolution coverage, let's jump and look at some of the other candidates. So coming from rawstory.com, Hillary seems to raise possibility of nuking terrorist safe havens. She promises, quote, heavy retaliation for terrorist harboring nations. New York Senator Hillary Clinton, finding herself in an unexpectedly close race with freshman Senator Barack Obama, flexed her national security muscles in the January 5th Democratic debate, raising the possibility of loosing nuclear weapons on countries that harbor terrorists who plot a nuclear attack on the U.S.
But let me just add that when you look at where we are, the stateless terrorist will operate from somewhere. I mean, part of our message has to be there is no safe haven. If we can demonstrate that the people responsible for planning the nuclear attack on our country may not themselves be in a government or associated with a state, but have a haven within one, then every state in the world must know we will retaliate against those states. There cannot be safe havens for stateless terrorists who are in these networks that are plotting to have the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the smuggling into our country or elsewhere of the kind of suitcase device that could cause such havoc. So I think we have to be very, very clear. You know, deterrence worked during the Cold War in large measure because the United States made it clear to the Soviet Union that there would be massive retaliation. We have to make it clear to those states that would give safe haven to stateless terrorists that would launch a nuclear attack against America that they would also face very heavy retaliation.
That's Hillary the Hawk. Now let's jump to thinkprogress.org and listen to what Manchurian McCain says. Like, I don't think Americans are concerned if we stay in Iraq for 10,000 years. Last week, Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, said it would be fine with him if the U.S. military stayed in Iraq for 100 years or even a million years. Meanwhile, of course, 59% say the U.S. should stick to a withdrawal timetable instead of keeping a significant number of troops in Iraq until the situation there gets better. But on CBS's Face the Nation, McCain claimed that Americans would not be concerned if the U.S. spends 10,000 years in Iraq, saying the point is, it's American casualties. We got to get Americans off the front lines, have the Iraqis as part of the blah 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 blah. I don't think Americans are concerned if we were there for 100 years or 1,000 years or 10,000 years. As Crooks and Liars notes on NBC's Meet the Press, McCain further expressed his desire for a permanent Iraq occupation, going so far as to suggest that he supports permanent bases in the country.
You said at one of your town halls recently that it was okay with you if we stayed in Iraq for 100 years. I mean, that requires some explanation.
It requires some explanation because I had a town hall meeting. We go back and forth. There was a man there who was very well informed about Iraq and firmly disagreed with me, and we had this exchange. He said, how long do we have to stay there? My point was, and continues to be, how long do we have to stay in Bosnia? How long do we have to stay in South Korea? How long are we going to stay in Japan? How long are we going to stay in Germany? All of those 50, 60 year period. No one complains. In fact, they contribute enormously, their presence, to stability in the world. The point is, it's American casualties. We got to get Americans off the front line, have the Iraqis, as part of the strategy, take over more and more of the responsibilities. And then I don't think Americans are concerned if we're there for 100 years or 1,000 years or 10,000 years. What they care about is the sacrifice of our most precious treasure, and that's American blood.
What kind of troop levels for the next 10, 20 years?
That's very hard to say. But the troops would be out of harm's way. That's the key to it.
Would you have permanent bases?
If that seems to be necessary in some respects, it depends on the threat.
So that's McCain saying we should stay in Iraq for 10,000 years with permanent bases and permanent empire. So we had Hillary the Hawk and Manchurian McCain. Now, thirdly, let's jump to Counterpunch with an article about who I'm sure is now all you guys' favorite candidate, now that, he managed to win in Iowa, but then amazingly he didn't win in New Hampshire. You're all going to jump to Barack Obama, and I'll mention a little more about this, but let's read the article coming from Counterpunch by Missy Comley Beatty. It's called In the Thrall of AIPAC. AIPAC, of course, is the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. The article is called Why Obama Can't Save Us. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh recently said that Barack Obama is our only hope to lead a reconciliation between the Muslim countries and the U.S. Why? Because Obama's father was a Muslim? I simply don't follow Hersh's logic here. Seems to me the actions of a president are more important than some familial affiliation with a particular religion. Not to mention that candidate Obama has aligned himself with Israel. These are some of Obama's comments during a speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, saying, quote, our job is to rebuild the road to real peace and lasting security throughout the region. Our job is to do more than lay out another roadmap. That effort begins with a clear and strong commitment to the security of Israel, our strongest ally in the region, and its only established democracy. That will always be my starting point. And calling for sustained military support to Israel, Obama said, we must preserve our total commitment to unique defense relationship with Israel by fully funding military assistance and continuing work on the Arrow and other related missile defense programs. For Barack Obama to say that our job is to lay out another roadmap for peace while we're providing military support to Israel as the country launches attacks on Palestinians is hypocrisy. There's more than a conflict of interest for the U.S. to go to the table, act as peace brokers, and make demands. But then, that's what we do as self-appointed police officers to the world. We decry the violence in Kenya. Condi Rice just made a statement that it must stop. But the violence perpetrated on the Iraqi and Afghan populations by her boss's policies continues without end. Our violence is good violence. Anyone else's is barbaric. It matters little to me that Barack Obama says he was against invading Iraq. After all, he votes to continue funding it. If this presidential candidate wanted to mend relationships with Muslims, he could start by voting against additional war funding. And he could say no to AIPAC, but that, of course, would be political suicide. Something I don't have posted up, but it's probably coming soon, is an article about Barack Obama and his chief foreign policy advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is, of course, under Carter and is, of course, a huge, huge neocon, warmonger, elite hawk. His kids are running around acting like they're not his kids. like Mika Brzezinski on MSNBC, and his son, I forget his son's name. Webster Tarpley posted up a nice piece about who Obama's advisors are, and they're warmongers through and through. And so, like I said last week, these are the people you're looking for quote-unquote change to come from. And so you poo-poo Ron Paul because he has a little R after his name, but you won't take the time to go look at his voting record. Look what he says, look what he means. And they can keep slinging the muck at him. It's not going to stick. We'll get to the old 9/11 truther question at the South Carolina debate last night in a few minutes. But we're going to jump back to more about Ron Paul in the New Hampshire primary, which, of course, now more and more and more is coming out about possible vote fraud in New Hampshire, vote fraud that affected Ron Paul and Barack Obama. So, firstly, from Paul Joseph Watson, New Hampshire District admits that Ron Paul votes were not counted. The head clerk of the New Hampshire town of Sutton has been forced to admit that Ron Paul received 31 votes. Yet, when the final amount was transferred to a summary sheet and sent out to the media, the total was listed as zero. The fiasco throws the entire primary into doubt and could lead to a recount, which Kucinich has filed for a recount in New Hampshire. As we reported earlier, and there's a link there for you, an entire family voted for Ron Paul in Sutton, yet when the voting on the map shown on the Politico website was posted, the total votes for Ron Paul were zero. Next, from RogueGovernment.com, vote fraud plagues New Hampshire primary. The New Hampshire voting results should not be considered credible in either the Republican or Democrat races. There's a great deal of circumstantial and hard evidence indicating vote fraud. The most glaring is the fact that 31 votes for Ron Paul were not counted in Sutton, New Hampshire. We also have a link up to a video up on LiveLeak. Sutton vote fraud mentioned during a C-SPAN call-in. Another article from Paul Joseph Watson, clear evidence of widespread vote fraud in New Hampshire. There were several major vote fraud issues to arise out of the New Hampshire primary, revolving mainly around, as we mentioned, Ron Paul and Barack Obama, who were both seemingly cheated out of third and first places, respectively, as a result of rigged, debolled voting machines and deliberate malfeasance in the counting of handwritten paper ballots. Finally, under my heading of Despite New Hampshire Chicanery, the Ron Paul Revolution Rules On, this was post-New Hampshire, pre-South Carolina debate. There's also a CNN video that found its way to the memory hole, but rescued thanks to, I'm not sure who upped it to YouTube, but I got it from truthnews.us. And there's also some other links about viewer records, New Hampshire vote flipping from Ron Paul to McCain. Bev Harris of blackboxvoting.org says that the Iowa caucuses had vote fraud. There's a link to see what New Hampshire residents can do about a recount. And also even a Ron Paul class lawsuit and former FBI Iowa fraud. So all that's there, and we're going to listen to a little bit of the clips, especially coming at the end, the CNN mention of possible vote fraud. There's also the C-SPAN caller, and also a little piece that theguardian.co.uk put together.
We have to stop the momentum of growing government.
We don't need more meddling.
Democratic candidates, you know, none of them have spoken up against the Patriot Act. None of them have spoken up against the abuses of habeas corpus or torture. Or no one is talking about these really important, crucial issues that are the basis of individual rights.
This message of limited government, bringing our troops home, taking care of Americans first, securing our borders.
The main one is the Iraq War, which I think is, at best, a terrible mistake.
We have squandered the goodwill that America had, in part because we have stopped being the America that earned that goodwill. And I think by returning to the Constitution, we could get that back.
For me personally, I love the Constitution, and I believe whatever form of government we have, if someone in public office takes an oath to support and defend this structure. They ought to do that, and none of them do it. None of them do it. Ron Paul does.
Ron Paul's got some passionate supporters out there. Let's listen in briefly to hear what he's saying.
They talk about the future, and they talk about the hope, and occasionally they even mention the Constitution. Can you imagine? But there is no doubt in my mind that we're on the right track. We're moving, and your generation, the young people of this country, have awakened, and this is just going to be the beginning of something very, very big for this country.
Next telephone call, El Paso, Texas, Republican line. Good morning, or rather, good evening.
Good evening. I wanted to call in, namely, and I don't want anyone to think that this is an expression of, you know, regret for my candidate or everything. My candidate is Dr. Ron Paul, and I'm running for him, furiously trying to get him elected. But this is actually a concern of mine that is independent of the reports that I'm hearing. I have a friend who lives in Sutton County in New Hampshire, and he, his aunt, and several people that he knows have voted for Dr. Ron Paul, and actually in all the reports that I've seen on the news and online, it's reporting that there are zero votes for Ron Paul in Sutton County. Now, I'm just calling in to express a concern that, you know, these are paper ballots that are fed into digital machines, and I think it's probably extremely wise that all of the precinct observers go through and count through the paper ballots, because this isn't just for Dr. Paul. It's to make sure that it's a fair election through and through. And it's just a strong concern that I have.
All right. Thanks very much.
Over the weekend, polls showed that Hillary Clinton was way behind Barack Obama. So how was she able to pull it off? What put her over the top? Bill Schneider is CNN senior political analyst. First question, Bill, why were the polls so far off? I mean, some polls had him 11 points out in front of her.
That's right. The average was about 7 points, and 8 polls were taken just before the primary, and they all showed Obama in the lead. Now, all the pollsters are unlikely to make the same mistake. So it must have been something that happened. What could have happened? There are 3 theories. One, that there was a late surge, perhaps associated with her show of emotion, with voters moving to her at the last second. A second is race. Many voters might have said to the pollsters they were going to vote for Barack Obama, but in the end, they couldn't do it, or they wouldn't do it. A third...
Well, this is what some African-American columnists have referred to as the voting booth conversion.
That's right. People tell pollsters they're going to vote for a black man, but in the end, they won't do it. The third, which you're hearing about all over the blogs, is there was some corruption of the voting machines, so therefore somebody interfered with the results.
Right.
I haven't tested them, but those are the theories.
Those are the theories of New Hampshire vote fraud affecting Ron Paul and Barack Obama. Now, finally, we have the most recent bit of the Ron Paul revolution. This was the Fox News debate last night in South Carolina. All the clips of Ron Paul's responses are posted up already on YouTube, thanks to Scanning the Waves, and I also got them from my man Doug at blacklistednews.com. And I even called into their show, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But let's listen to the Honorable Dr. Ron Paul at last night's debate.
Do you support a government program to stimulate the economy?
Well, government program is too vague. What kind of a government program? If it's appropriating money and trying to stimulate that way and spend more money, no, that would be the wrong thing to do. But a government program of a reduced tax burden, yes, that would be. Also, to solve this problem, you have to understand why we're in a recession. I believe we're in a recession. I think it's going to get a lot worse. If we continue to do the wrong things that we've done in the past, that it's going to be delayed, just as what happened in the Depression.
Many of your supporters call themselves 9/11 truthers. They believe that the U.S. government was in some way complicit with the 9/11 attacks or covered it up. Are you tonight prepared to either embrace that rhetoric or ask those supporters to abandon it or divorce themselves from your candidacy?
Well, I can't tell people what to do, but I've abandoned those viewpoints. I don't believe that, and that's all. That's the only thing that is important. And so I don't endorse anything they say, but I would like to take an opportunity to talk about the issue that we've been debating here for the last 20 minutes.
Sir, would you ask them to cease that rhetoric tonight on your behalf?
Well, it doesn't do me any good, so if they care about me, they should. But the only thing I have control over is what I believe and what I say. I can't tell them what to do, so I don't endorse what they say, and I don't believe that. So please, could I participate in the current debate rather than sticking this out?
Please do. Please do.
I would certainly urge a lot more caution than I'm hearing here tonight. It reminds me of what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin. We went to a war there, then later on found out there was a lot of false information. So here we have, put it in perspective, we have five small speedboats attacking U.S. Navy with a destroyer. They could take care of those speedboats in about 5 seconds. And here we're ready to start World War III over this. And now, guess what? Today, the Navy commander of the Fifth Fleet was on ABC and announced that, you know, that voice might not have come from those vessels. We support both sides, you know, not only with the Palestinians, but the Lebanese and all the Arab nations. We support Israel, and we try to have this balance. But I think it'd be much better to have a balance by being out of there. And I think there would be a greater incentive for Israel and the Palestinian and all the Arab nations to come together and talk, because I think we get in the way too often of these. And besides, it's costing us a lot of money. It's costing us lives now. And it's time that we come to the point where we believe the world can solve some of their problems without us. I'm talking exactly about that, because that's what we have been doing. We used to support Saddam Hussein, and we used to be allied with Osama bin Laden. And what I want to do is stop that. Well, who are our friends one day turn out to be our enemies. Right now, we finally got rid of Saddam Hussein. And what are we doing now? We're rearming the Sunnis, the old henchmen of Saddam Hussein. What are they going to do with those, all those weapons we're giving the Sunnis in Baghdad? So look out. Believe me, that war is not over. And right now they're demanding more troops in Afghanistan. And some people, like the senator, he thinks we should be there for 100 years if necessary. How can he commit the young people of this world, five more generations, to be in Iraq if it's necessary? I say it's time to come home.
Senator McCain, yes.
In many ways, we treat Israel as a stepchild. We do not give them responsibility that they deserve. We undermine their national sovereignty. We don't let them design their own peace treaties with their neighbors. And then we turn around and say that when you want to do that, or you want to defend your borders, they have to check it out with us. I think Israel would be a lot safer. I made the point earlier. We give three times as much money to the Arabs. Why do we arm their enemies? So if you care about Israel, you should be against all the weapons that go to the Arab nations. And I just don't see any purpose in not treating Israel in an adult fashion. Let me see if I get this right. We need to borrow $10 billion from China, and then we give it to Musharraf, who's a military dictator who overthrew an elected government, and then we go to war, we lose all these lives promoting democracy in Iraq. I mean, what's going on here? Well, I don't know that, but I don't know if that's necessarily true. But I do think we should enforce the law. And the law says that illegals shouldn't be here and that we shouldn't have amnesty. But I think this whole thing should be thought of more in economic terms. Maybe I think about economics too much, but there is something said in economics that if you subsidize something, you get more of it. And this is what we do. We encourage it by giving free medical care and free education and the promise of amnesty. And no wonder more will come.
When I look at someone like Giuliani, okay, I mean, well, before I get on my little rant here, it seems that we have a call. Caller, are you there?
Hey, what's up, fellas? This is Media Monarchy out in New Oregon.
Hey, hey, how's it going,
James? Sir? How you doing, bud?
Doing well. I just clicked in, and it's McCain that Kissinger is endorsing.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks
for
the update.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, this is the same guy that told us, you know, 100-year war, very palatable. The American people will love it. They will love this. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, actually, the other bit of what I was actually calling in about is I'm watching the debate live right now, streaming on Pro News, and Carl Cameron pointedly just asked us, this was just a couple minutes ago, asked Ron Paul if he would dismiss and disown and tell those 9/11 truthers to knock it off.
oh, like he's the conduit for 9/11 truth, and that he's the middle manager, and somehow he can talk to these people because he's aligned with the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, this is what they're trying to hang on him. You know, I don't know, James, did you see the Glenn Beck interview?
You mentioned the Glenn Beck interview with Ron Paul, and I hadn't seen that. But Glenn Beck's kind of weird that way, where he'll kind of turn off and on the anti-New World Order bit, I think, when it suits him. I think it's interesting to watch in a lot of the mainstream media how they have to give play to the quote-unquote conspiracy theory world, because they realize that's where most people have kind of shifted to. At least, if not shifted to, then are at least more aware of it, and they have to address it if they're going to stay anyway relevant. But it's interesting to see Carl Cameron just a few minutes ago on this live Fox debate ask Ron Paul about 9/11 truth and would he distance himself from it and would he tell them to stop. And he sort of quickly addressed it but said, you know, he can't tell people what to do. You know, he doesn't agree with it, and he's said that before. But it's interesting that it was Carl Cameron, because if anyone in the mainstream media would know anything about unanswered questions about 9/11, Carl Cameron would be one of them. He's got that great four-part story that I think just ran in maybe October, November 2001 about all the Israeli spy rings and the art students and all of that.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
That's Donovan with the Universal Soldier, and I got to give thanks to Alan Watt at cuttingthroughthematrix.com for turning me onto that song. I'm a bit of a Donovan fan, but I'd never heard Universal Soldier, and I heard Alan Watt play it on his fantastic show on We the People Radio Network. You're listening to this fantastic show called Media Monarchy. It's episode 58, coming to you live January 11th, 2008 from the Portland Radio Authority, live every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time at praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time on the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. And you can, of course, hit me up on MySpace, Yahoo, Facebook, Dig, YouTube, and all that with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And the podcasts are available anytime thanks to radioforall.net and archive.org. Moving on into hour number two of this episode 58, we're going to jump to HuffingtonPost.com and do a little talk about the gangsters, the banksters. Ex-Goldman Sachs associate sentenced for multiple insider trading schemes. Coming from the New York Times as well. A former Goldman Sachs associate who was accused of masterminding one of the broadest insider trading conspiracies in years was sentenced on Thursday to nearly 5 years in prison. Eugene Plotkin, sentenced in an insider trading case. He's 28. He's a Harvard graduate who dabbled in filmmaking and ballroom dancing. But now he's been sentenced to 4 years and 9 months by a federal district judge in Manhattan. The sentence was the minimum under a plea agreement. Mr. Plotkin's arrest in April of 2006 was the first of a number of insider trading cases brought by federal prosecutors and the Securities and Exchange Commission that year and 2007. So jumping to SourceWatch.org and the Goldman Sachs entry, GoldmanSachsGS.com, founded in 1869, describes itself as a leading global investment banking, securities, and investment management firm that provides a wide range of services worldwide to a blah, 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 blah. And you can read about their political contributions and Hank Paulson, who's, of course, connected to Bush and was the Secretary of the Department of Treasury. You can look at their lobbying and their personnel. And then I also have Eugene Plotkin's bio linked up. Formerly a research analyst at Goldman Sachs, convicted of insider trading. He pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit securities fraud and 8 counts of insider trading. Now, this bio goes over his full scam and what he pulled off and how it involves, of course, the Southern District of Manhattan, as we've mentioned many, 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 many times before. And I always got to thank my man Richard Andrew Grove at 911synchronicity.com for turning me on to what goes on and has gone on in the Southern District of Manhattan. We also have a little definition of insider trading, kids. That's the trading of a corporation's stock or other securities like bonds or stock options by corporate insiders, such as officers, key employees, directors, or holders of more than 10% of the firm's shares. Insider trading may be perfectly legal, but the term is frequently used in the pejorative sense to refer to a practice illegal in many jurisdictions in which an insider or a related party trades based on material non-public information that's obtained during the performance of the insider's duties at the corporation or info that's otherwise misappropriated. And you can, of course, read about all that and all that money fraud that's gone on as the crazies and the neocons have been in control for the last couple of decades. Staying on the topic of banksters and money manipulation, once again, my man Lee Rogers at RogueGovernment.com. Bush meets with Plunge Protection Team. George W. Bush on January 4th, 2008, met with the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, otherwise known as the Plunge Protection Team. The group, which consists of the Securities and Exchange Chairman, Treasury Secretary, Federal Reserve Chairman, and Futures Trading Commission Chairman, was formed following the stock market crash of 87, commonly referred to as Black Monday. It's interesting to see Bush meet with a group that was formed to prevent future stock market and economic crashes, yet at the same time make claims that the economy should do better later in the year. Obviously, with oil at around $100 a barrel, the mortgage crisis, massive losses in the banking system, gold over $870 an ounce, and the plunging value of the U.S. dollar, the economy is in the process of unraveling. Bush is merely attempting to put a positive spin on an increasingly more horrifying economic situation by admitting there are problems, but that they're not as bad as everyone thinks that they is. So, with the link to the WhiteHouse.gov page, Bush made the following statement regarding his meeting with the Plunge Protection Team. I had quite a fascinating and productive meeting with the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, chaired by Secretary Paulson, who we just mentioned, involved with Goldman Sachs and Eugene Plotkin's insider trading. Not directly, but pretty damn close. I want to thank the members for working diligently to monitor our capital market system, our financial system. And while there is some uncertainty, the report is that the financial markets are strong and solid. And I want to thank you for being diligent. Back to Lee Rogers and RogueGovernment.com. The fact that the administration is actually willing to admit that there might be some economic problems means that the situation is certainly not good. This administration has completely ignored the irrational monetary policy of the Federal Reserve throughout the decade. Of course, Bush would not be meeting with the Plunge Protection Team unless they are afraid of a financial collapse. And of course, in the news this morning is that Bank of America is buying Countrywide, one of the failing and flailing, I believe, British banks. The plunge protection team operates in a secretive manner, and they've consistently denied FOIA requests from the New York Post and other people that have sent inquiries to the U.S. Treasury to determine if this group is actively engaged in manipulating markets and why they are doing so. The secrecy of the U.S. Treasury in not revealing this information is essentially an admission that they are doing just that. If they have nothing to hide, why can't they just honor their requests? That's what they ask us all the time. There's a little question that we are facing a global depression because the Federal Reserve has been given carte blanche to print U.S. dollars out of thin air. This policy has allowed the Federal Reserve to devalue the U.S. dollar, and we're approaching a situation where the supply of U.S. dollars is going way up and the demand for U.S. dollars is going way down. This has resulted in the falling value of the U.S. dollar. If the slide in the U.S. dollar continues, we'll face a depression with hyperinflation, and it will not be a good situation at all. Some financial analysts have even said that we're shaping up for a scenario worse than what happened in 1929. And the link is there for you to read about it. Last paragraph, the London Telegraph, also with a link, issued a report on Bush meeting with the plunge protection team, further analyzing the significance of the meeting. Clearly, this is a disturbing event, and people need to be prepared for an economic calamity of epic proportions. A global economic depression with massive hyperinflation looks to be in the works. And now, a few minutes ago, we of course heard Ron Paul say, oh, maybe I talk about money too much, but it's the key to all these things going on. Watching the debate last night with my girlfriend, it was kind of cool to see the light bulb go off over her head after listening to people like McCain and Giuliani. Threw up her hands and said, God, if Giuliani would get the nomination, I'd have to vote for Hillary Clinton. Ding! And there it is. And that's the key. And that's what we've mentioned on the show time and time again, is that it seems pretty much set that Hillary is to get the nomination. The Bush-Clinton crime family must, nay, will go on. And so, of course, the GOP is running a bunch of dead horses that aren't meant to win. Because if you put someone like McCain or Giuliani up against Hillary, that's a no-brainer, I guess. Anyway, I digress. Coming from Minionville.com, another article about the plunge protection team. That one's posted up. They also point out the Telegraph and all the unusual suspects and the invisible hand. And we've, of course, been eyeing this for a long time. And it's all intervention, basically trying to put their finger in the dike of the collapse that they've built up. And now they realize that maybe they've built the collapse too much, and they may lose their asses. They don't mind if we lose our asses, but if they fuck the whole thing, they're screwed too. I've got the link up to the working group on financial markets. Like I said, it was created after the 87 crash by Ronald Reagan. Wikipedia says the group was established explicitly in response to the events in the financial markets surrounding October 19th, 1987. They, of course, call it Black Monday, to give recommendations and yada yada. They do mention, of course, one theory regarding the working group refers to it as the plunge protection team. This theory claims that the working group is a scheme to manipulate U.S. stock markets in the event of a market crash by using government funds to buy stocks. The term plunge protection team was originally the headline for an article in the Washington Post by staff writer Brett D. Fromson from February 23, 1997. He did not invent the term. It was added later by a copy desk editor as a sensational nickname for the working group. Okay, here we go now. Our man Shrub, of course, spent this last week living it up in Israel. And all the things that swirled around that, like war games and Navy jets crashing and this confrontation with supposed Iranians. And so we're going to go through all this latest of our man Bush abroad with our stepchild Israel. So first, from The Guardian, while in Israel, Bush criticized settlements U.S. President George Bush criticized the presence of unauthorized settlements in the West Bank in his first press conference inside Israel. Standing alongside the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, Bush was asked about the settlements. He said, "Outposts? Yeah, they ought to go." The criticisms were a reiteration of statements he made last week that small settlements, not authorized by the Israeli government, were an impediment to peace. Their removal is a key part of the revived U.S. quote-unquote roadmap. Staying at The Guardian and getting into this supposed Iranian confrontation that news is still spilling out about. First report from The Guardian, like I said, the U.S., quote, almost opened fire on Iranian ships. U.S. warships came close to opening fire on Iranian vessels in the Strait of Hormuz over the weekend, the Pentagon said. The incident followed a series of, quote, aggressive provocations by five boats believed to belong to Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard. U.S. officials told CNN the boats were attack craft, which had approached U.S. vessels in international waters. This was last Saturday, the 5th. Oil prices rose about 30 cents to more than $98 or 50 pounds a barrel. $98 a barrel following the incident, with traders citing increased risk of possible disruptions to oil shipments, which of course would be the first thing that would happen if a conflagration would open up between the U.S. and Iran. They would shut down the Straits of Hormuz, they would block off oil, and you know the rest. So as this story broke, immediately following it, is Iran said, that shit's fake. And the New York Times printed as much. So January 10th, Dateline Tehran, Iran's Revolutionary Guard accused the United States on Wednesday of fabricating a video showing Iranian speedboats confronting U.S. Navy warships in the Persian Gulf. Images released by the U.S. Department of Defense about the Navy vessels were made from file pictures, and the audio was fabricated, an unnamed Revolutionary Guard official said, according to Fars news agency, the semi-official. And they have close links to the Revolutionary Guard. It was the first time Iran had commented on the video that the Pentagon released Tuesday. The audio, which we're going to hear in a minute, includes the statement that says, I am coming to you. You will explode after a few minutes. Or some transcripts say a couple minutes. It depends on which video you look at. The voice was recorded from the internationally recognized channel for ship-to-ship communications. The Pentagon immediately dismissed the assertion that the video, which shows Iranian speedboats maneuvering around and among Navy warships, had been fabricated. Brian Whitman, Pentagon spokesman, says Iran's allegation is absurd, factually incorrect, and reflects the lack of seriousness with which they take this serious incident. And of course, Wall Street wobbled on Iran worries. This coming from the AP. Wall Street fluctuated Monday after the Bush administration warned Iran following an incident involving that country's forces and three U.S. Navy ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Stocks had opened higher amid speculation about future interest rate cuts, but pared gains after reports of the administration's comments appeared on news services. U.S. forces were on the verge of firing on the Iranian boats in the early Sunday incident when the boats turned away and moved. The White House on Monday warned it will confront Iranian behavior if it threatens the U.S. or its allies. And we also had, while Bush was, again, living it up in Israel, Jerusalem lights to go out so Bush can enjoy the sunrise. Lights in the old city of Jerusalem will be turned off before dawn this week so visiting U.S. President George W. Bush can get a better view of the sun rising over its ancient walls. Bush, who arrived in the Middle East last Wednesday for a visit lasting more than a week, had made a request to watch the sunrise over the old city from his suite at the King David Hotel. And I have a link. You can go to the King David Hotel's website. So there you have Bush having the lights turned off so he can enjoy the sunrise in Jerusalem. Jumping back to The Guardian, they report that more than 10,000 police guarded Bush during the Israel visit. Israeli officials in Jerusalem are to deploy more than 10,000 police officers in a vast security operation ahead of the arrival of George W. Bush. Graffiti was being cleaned off the walls, road markings were being repainted, and hundreds of American flags were put up across the city. And of course, the floodlights which illuminate the stone ramparts of the old city. You know, what it just said. After turning out the lights for Bush, Israel turns up the hip-hop. President George W. Bush's first visit to Israel has been notable both for its unprecedented level of security, said to be costing $25,000 an hour, and ceremonial moments marked by a zeal for perfect planning. Of course, the lights in the city went off so Georgie could watch it from the King David Hotel, because he thinks he's King George. During a ceremony at Israeli President Shimon Peres' official residence, Bush was welcomed by school children waving U.S. and Israeli flags and singing a pop-styled medley of Hava Nagilah. The two then moved to another room where Bush signed a visitor's book, and they were serenaded by a girl singing Over the Rainbow in Hebrew and English. And there was a folk dance in Russian outfits, and one press account labeled the Hava Nagilah update as a hip-hop version, and another one called it disco. Now, it was tough to stay on top of all these changes in this week, with Bush in Israel, with the Iran incident, with even some Navy jets crashing, but let's listen to a moment of Bush in Israel and some hip-hop Hava Nagilah.
What a beautiful day.
Thank you. It is. I think we played for you.
Something. You did.
The United States and Israel are strong allies. The source of that strength is a shared belief in the power of human freedom. We will do more than defend ourselves. We seek lasting peace. We see a new opportunity for peace here in the Holy Land and for freedom across the region.
You are our strongest and most trusted ally in the battle against terrorism and fundamentalism, and a staunch supporter of our quest for peace and stability. Through your vision, exceptional courage, and determination in the face of evil and terror, your solidarity with the people of Israel has won you the love and admiration of all the citizens of Israel.
So that shrub in Israel, and you can of course click on and watch that video on MediaMonarchy.com of Bush dancing very rigidly in an Al Gore-like fashion. But moving quickly forward, I mentioned the Navy fighter jets crashing in the Persian Gulf. This coming from the AP, this coming Monday, January 7th, two U.S. Navy fighter jets plunged into the Persian Gulf Monday after what initial reports suggest was a mid-air collision. All three pilots ejected safely from the planes and were headed back to the USS Harry Truman, the aircraft carrier they were operating from. This, according to the official, who requested anonymity because the information was preliminary and not yet released publicly. No other details of the crash were released. One of the F-18 jets that crashed held two pilots, the other held just one, and this happened amid the reports coming out of the Iranian confrontation. And there's a video I stole from WAVY and posted up to YouTube. So it's Wavy Navy.
Three naval aviators are safe tonight after a mid-air collision between two F-18 Super Hornets. This happened off the Norfolk base USS Harry S. Truman deployed in the Persian Gulf. Sending your side military reporter Melanie Woodrow is following this story. She's live now from the Truman's home port at Naval Station Norfolk. Melanie.
Tom, obviously a very fortunate outcome here tonight. Now, the Navy has not released what squadron those three aviators were with, but we do know they are safe back on the Truman tonight after plunging into the Persian Gulf.
The
commander of the 5th Fleet broke the news in a press conference this afternoon.
Earlier this evening, local time in the Gulf, we had a mid-air collision between two F-18 Super Hornets operating off the Harry S. Truman in the northern Arabian Gulf.
Three aviators were involved, one aircraft carrying two, the other one. All three pilots ejected safely.
The two aircraft were lost. The three aviators have been safely recovered aboard USS Harry S. Truman in good condition and are being checked out medically.
Lieutenant John Gay, a spokesman for the 5th Fleet, could not say whether the collision was a result of pilot error or something else.
It would be inappropriate to speculate what caused the problem. It's under investigation, and they'll look through all the, you know, all the details and records to determine what caused this accident.
As for whether the three pilots will remain deployed,
that's a determination that's going to have to be made by the medical physician. I mean, it appears that all three are in good condition right now. They'll get a thorough examination to determine their duty status.
Again, a very positive outcome for those three aviators tonight. Now, you may remember back in August, an E-2C Hawkeye crashed following takeoff from the Truman. That was about 150 miles southeast of the Virginia Capes, and three naval aviators were killed in that crash. Lieutenant John Gay tells me that as of right now, there does not appear to be any relationship between the two crashes. Reporting live at Naval Station Norfolk, Melanie Woodrow, 10 on your side.
And that video is available up on youtube.com/mediamonarchy. Now, we're going to jump to thinkprogress.org while we're staying on the Iranian so-called naval confrontation. Thinkprogress.org and numerous other places are reporting that, of course, the Pentagon has backtracked on the naval confrontation with Iran and says that the threat may not have come from Iranians. Earlier this week, the Pentagon said that three of its Navy ships in the Strait of Hormuz had been harassed and provoked by Iranian speedboats. The Navy had said it felt so threatened that it was about to open fire on the boats. And a four-minute video of the episode provided to the public by the Pentagon contained one particularly harrowing moment where I said, of course, earlier, "I am coming to you," a heavily accented voice says in English. Navy officials said the voice was recorded from the internationally recognized bridge-to-bridge radio channel.
"I am coming to you.
Inbound small craft, you are approaching a coalition warship operating in international waters. Your identity is not known, your intentions are unclear. You are standing into danger and may be subject to defensive measures. Approach your established communications now, or alter course immediately to remain clear. Request you alter course immediately to remain clear. You will explode after a few minutes."
The Iranians sent a threatening message.
"I'm coming to you."
Military officials say the hopper was within seconds of opening fire. But the threat from the Iranians grew more ominous. The speedboats turned away at the last second, and no shots were fired. At the White House today, President Bush called it a dangerous situation.
"I'm telling you what I think it was. I think it was a provocative act."
The whole video all looks and sounds completely fucking bogus. It's all posted up and you can go watch it, but you just heard the bad Arnold Schwarzenegger type, "I'm coming to you." And of course the video came from the Pentagon, you know, and the other great video hits they brought us, like the five frames of the Pentagon on 9/11. Anyway, some bloggers were immediately skeptical, noting the voice did not sound Iranian. Iran at least released its own video, arguing the footage did not show any Iranian boats approaching the U.S. vessel, nor any provocation. And then the Navy acknowledged that the verbal threat made in the tape may not have been Iranian, saying, quote, "We're saying that we cannot make a direct connection to the boats there," said the spokesperson. "It could have come from the shore, from another ship passing by. However, it happened in the middle of all the very unusual activity. So as we assess the information and situation, we still put it in the total aggregate of what happened Sunday morning. I guess we're not saying that it absolutely came from the boats, but we're not saying it absolutely didn't." Without definitive evidence that it was Iran who was making the provocative verbal threats, Bush nevertheless seized on the episode and viewed it as a provocative act. There will be serious consequences if they attack our ships, pure and simple. And this is coming from thinkprogress.org, and they've got a lot of links and updates at a Pentagon news conference. Robert Gates was questioned about this provocation.
You said yesterday that other similar incidents have occurred. Can you say what about this incident on Sunday was particularly different that created such a stir, and whether you think it represents a change in military posture by Iran? And also, what is your view of the video that the Iranians released and their charges that the U.S. is fabricating some of this?
Well, with respect to the latter and the charges of fabrication, I think that the most appropriate answer is actually the one that I heard on television last night from former Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen, who said, "Are you going to believe me or your lying eyes?" I think that aptly characterizes and appropriately characterizes the Iranian claim. I think that what concerned us was first the fact that there were five of these boats, and the second that they came as close as they did to our ships and behaved in what appeared to be a pretty aggressive manner. So I think it's all of those things that that raised concerns. My impression is that, and I was simply briefed in summary when I was in San Diego, that there had been a couple of similar instances last year, but those briefing me didn't give me any details, but I have the impression that the numbers were fewer and perhaps the actions weren't as aggressive.
Now, first, Robert Gates doesn't, of course, know that "Who you going to believe me, or who you going to believe me or your lying eyes" is, of course, a Groucho Marx quote. But I have Robert Gates's bio from SourceWatch.org linked up, and you can read about some of his great quotes, like saying, "I don't know whether invading Iraq was a good idea," or "I'm no expert on Iraq," and more and more and more. And of course, maybe his involvement in Operation Phoenix. But coming from the Danger Room blog on Wired yet again. And I'll throw this out real quick. Last week we covered the sleeping security guards at nuclear plants, and I had a video of that I posted up to YouTube, Danger Room, on the Wired.com page, posted up my YouTube video. So I got thousands of YouTube hits from that. So thank you, Danger Room. But they have posted up U.S. Navy unsure Iranians made threat. Hold off the invasion force. It turns out that the U.S. military isn't totally 100% completely sure that the threatening voice involved in the recent naval face-off was even from Iranian forces. And all those links are there. Like I said, the Think Progress page has a dozen links, and you can read all about that. However, in case you're wondering, but why would they fake it? Why would they lie about it? They would never do that. Let's talk about the Gulf of Tonkin, which more and more has come out this week. And you wonder sometimes, the spook world works in mysterious ways. Just as we're looking at this possible false flag confrontation in Iranian waters, we have information coming out that reaffirms what we already knew. And that's that the Gulf of Tonkin event was a staged event to get us publicly into the Vietnam War. But Robert McNamara didn't say that on the Fog of War. Of course the defense secretary isn't going to say we inflated the Gulf of Tonkin as an escalation to get into the war. We don't need him to say that. We have the NSA records. We've got books and all the documentation and all the interviews. So, coming from globalresearch.ca, an ominous non-event, the Gulf of Tonkin and the Strait of Hormuz. This is all posted up under my heading of Hormuz and Tonkin, false flags, then and now. But Robert Fantina writes, as the U.S. government continues to demonstrate its inability to learn from history, an alarming report from the Strait of Hormuz was broadcast to the world on January 7th. They, of course, mentioned the confrontation. Those either old enough to remember or cognizant enough to understand history will immediately be reminded of the infamous Gulf of Tonkin incident reported on August 2nd, 1964. Of course, conveniently after Kennedy was out of the way and LBJ was free to escalate the Vietnam War. On that day, the U.S. destroyer Maddox, on an espionage mission in the Gulf of Tonkin off the Vietnam coast, reported being fired on by North Vietnamese torpedo patrol boats. In response, the Maddox fired back, sinking one boat. Tensions in the area were already growing, and now the world watched and waited. On August 4th of that same year, the Maddox and the C. Turner Joy, another destroyer, were again patrolling the Gulf of Tonkin. Instruments on the Maddox indicated that it was either attacked or was under attack, and both the Maddox and the C. Turner Joy began firing back with assistance from U.S. air power. It was less than 24 hours later when the captain concluded that there might not have been an attack. Why the instruments indicated otherwise was not clearly explained. The pilot of a Crusader jet, James B. Stockdale, undertook a reconnaissance flight over the Gulf that evening. He was asked if he saw any North Vietnamese attack vessels. Mr. Stockdale did not equivocate in his response, said he, quote, "Not a one. No boats, no wakes, no ricochets off boats, no boat impacts, no torpedo wakes, nothing but Black Sea and American firepower." End fucking quote. So let's move on. Let's move to 911blogger.com. Gulf of Tonkin confirmed as false flag. And they link up the AFP report, but they mention, posted up by Reprehensor, "For anyone still harboring doubts about the status of the Gulf of Tonkin incident as an example of a false flag event, a report made by the NSA clears it up. The existence of the report was revealed a couple of years ago, but the actual report has now been made public, and you can view it via the Federation of American Scientists blog Secrecy News, just in time to coincide with the latest Strait of Hormuz incident aimed at Iran." And the AFP report, their headline, "Report Reveals Vietnam War Hoaxes and Faked Attacks." North Vietnamese made hoax calls to get the U.S. military to bomb its own units during the Vietnam War, according to declassified information that also confirmed U.S. officials faked an incident to escalate the war. Raw Story also runs that AFP report. So I won't belabor it because I'm running out of time, but there you go. Strait of Hormuz, Gulf of Tonkin, false flag attacks. Let's get back to home. Let's get back to homeland stupidity. They won't pay their wiretap phone bills, so they got cut off. This coming from the Washington Post. In today's edition, page A15, telecommunications companies have repeatedly cut off FBI access to wiretaps of alleged terrorists and criminal suspects, because, of course, you know, all crime is terror. Terror and criminals. Because the Bureau did not pay its phone bills. According to the results of an audit released yesterday, the report by Justice Department Inspector General Glenn A. Fine said that more than half of nearly 1,000 FBI telecommunication bills reviewed by investigators were not paid on time, including one invoice for $66,000 at an unidentified field office. The report cited a case in which an order obtained under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, which covers clandestine wiretaps of terrorism and espionage suspects, was halted because of, quote, untimely payment. Late payments have resulted in telecommunications carriers actually disconnecting phone lines established to deliver surveillance results to the FBI, resulting in lost evidence. And that's all posted up in Fine's 7-page summary of the audit's findings, and all those links are there. Threat level also posted the story, FBI wiretap cut off after feds fail to pay telecom spying bills. They've got the links up. Lots of quotes, lots of good stuff. As in the clip I played a little while ago of me calling in to Intel Strike Report last night to talk to Doug from BlacklistedNews.com and Michael from thought-criminal.org, Doug mentioned that he had posted up my story about the Pentagon wanting an Afghana surge, and I almost coined that term. If you Google, or at least as of this morning, if you Googled Afghana surge, there's only one other mention of the word Afghana surge, and that happened about a month ago. So I'm the second person. So I almost coined a new word, but let's see if we can get it out there into the world and see if Afghana surge can become our next catchphrase, like, "Don't tase me, bro." But anyway, AP is reporting that 3,000 more Marines are going to go to Afghanistan in April to bolster efforts to hold off another expected Taliban offensive in the spring, military officials said January 9th. The move represents a shift in Pentagon thinking that has been slowly developing after months of repeated insistence that the U.S. was not inclined to fill the need for as many as 7,500 more troops that commanders have asked for there. Indeed, Defense Secretary Robert Gates pressed NATO allies to contribute the extra forces. That's posted up on military.com. ThinkProgress.org also has Pentagon Weighs Afghanistan Surge, which, of course, when they say they're thinking about it, means that they're going to do it, protest or not. But staying on the topic of homeland stupidity, this one actually in London, this coming from EastLondonAdvertiser.co.uk, spy in sky drones for 2012 Olympics spark police state fear. Robot drones may be used by the RAF, Royal Air Force, for surveillance and intelligence gathering during the 2012 Olympic Games. The drones, or UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, which are fitted with infrared sensors and electronic eavesdropping equipment, will be able to provide a bird's-eye view of the crowds across East London. Now, there's a good flashback link to a story by Steve Watson going back to February 6th, 2007, 2012 London Olympics police state opening ceremony. A combination of leaked documents and public policy debate has recently revealed that the British government is preparing to use the 2012 Olympic Games in London as a showcase for multiple Big Brother police state operations and technologies. The London Telegraph reported that a memo entitled Number 10, Policy Working Group on Security, Crime and Justice, asks, quote, to what extent should the expectation of liberty be eroded by legitimate intrusions in the interests of security of the wider public? So you got to hand it to Infowars.net and Steve Watson. They reported on London Olympics 2012 and their police state actions back in February of 2007. And that's linked up for you as, of course, the definition in Wikipedia entry of a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle. I mentioned this a few weeks ago, and again, say what you will, but the John Birch Society was ahead of the curve on this, but now it's posted up on the Danger Room blog. Forest rangers get stun guns. Smokey the Bear now packs a stun gun. That's right, the U.S. Forest Service recently purchased 700 tasers for its rangers, and at least one group of federal workers is none too happy about it. They're called Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER. They say that the $600,000 stun gun buy isn't justified, especially when the Forest Service is struggling financially. And there's another story on govexec.com. Group rips cash-strapped Forest Service for purchasing tasers. Now the question is, why would they buy a bunch of tasers? What do they need tasers for? The media monarchy conspiracy theory is that when the shit goes down and people try and go to the woods and hide, there are going to be a bunch of forest rangers with tasers to tase you, bro. But moving on, we're going to look at some kitty biometrics, and we're also going to look at Big Pharma. The interesting thing about Big Pharma, coming from ScienceDaily.com, they spend more money on advertising than actual research and development. A new study by two York University researchers estimates the U.S. pharmaceutical industry spends almost twice as much on promotion as it does on research and development, contrary, of course, to the industry's claims, because they're too busy trying to force you to take Gardasil or Vioxx or what the hell ever. But the kitty biometrics are being protested by parents. Biometrics is one of the fastest growing areas of homeland security. But the expanding use of fingerprints and retinal scans to school-age children is prompting some parents to complain. According to one news report, a lawmaker in Arizona wants to limit the use of biometrics in schools. I certainly wouldn't want my children to be fingerprinted or have an iris scan or anything like that, says Senator Karen Johnson, a Republican of Mesa, Arizona. And that original report is coming from the Scottsdale Tribune. Use of biometrics in schools concerns parents. Of course, because they're training their kids to be retinal scan thumbprinted slaves. Jumping to the Washington Post now, this coming Wednesday, January 9th, New York really, really wants more bioweapon sensors. City officials last month quietly activated some of the nation's newest generation of early warning sensors to detect a biological attack, turning on a limited number of filing cabinet-sized air filters in sensitive high-volume areas of Manhattan. But city officials say their effort to expand the program has run into surprising resistance from the White House, which is not widely deploying the machines. Now, of course, the simple explanation, and there's actually a photo of these little biological weapons monitors that you can see up on the page. They want to amp up all this police state security, but then they don't want to fund it all the way. I'm not saying it should be, but they don't even follow through on what they say they want to do. But there's also a UPI report, Biological Weapon Monitors ire New York City, so there's a battle between Manhattan and Washington about these bioterror sensors. We've mentioned the Navy and their animal-killing sonar before, but there's more reports. This is from the LA Times. Navy must cut sonar use off California. A federal judge in Los Angeles on Thursday, January 3rd, ordered the toughest set of restrictions ever imposed on the U.S. Navy's use of mid-frequency sonar off the Southern California coast as part of a protracted court battle to protect whales and other marine mammals from underwater sonic blasts. The order was the first time the judges spelled out specific rules the Navy must follow to avoid a court-imposed ban on training missions with a type of sonar that has been linked to the death and panicked behavior of whales and dolphins. Like, I wonder why they're all beaching themselves. If you go to whaleandsonar.navy.mil, you can read their understanding sonar and passive sonar and active sonar and their explanations of all that. But we're going to move forward again, and we're going to mention HAARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, H-A-A-R-P. The Russians are calling it a geophysical weapon. We, of course, know that it can affect the weather, it's heating up the ionosphere, and it could even affect your brain. So a Russian journal has come out and said that HAARP could capsize the planet. Just when you think you've heard all the possible far-out theories behind the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, HAARP, in Alaska, leave it to the Russians to come up with one better. Forget mind control. The Russians think HAARP is a geophysical weapon that's going to capsize the planet. HAARP, just by way of reminder for those who don't obsessively follow its progress, is a military project that's supposed to study the ionosphere and use it to enhance communications and surveillance systems for both civilian and defense purposes. In more recent years, the Pentagon has also expressed interest in using HAARP to, quote, mitigate the effects of high-altitude nuclear explosions. However, HAARP's use of an antenna array operating in the high-frequency range has also prompted tons and tons of other theories about its uses, ranging from weather control to altering human behavior.
And those, as far as I know, maybe they are affecting us.
Signals in the same frequency range can affect human mood. The human brain operates on very low frequencies. For example, when we're thinking, actively, we're generating about 13, 14 cycles per second. When we're meditating, we're generating 8 cycles per second. And when we're asleep, the brain waves are running at about 4 cycles per second. And HAARP is capable of generating all of these frequencies. These kinds of signals can control the human brain. And if you can control these frequencies and multiples of these frequencies and various combinations, you can control all kinds of emotions. You can generate happiness. You can generate sadness. You can generate any mood you want. My entire life has been devoted to the study of the effects of electromagnetic energies on the human mind. When I was 13 years old, I invented a device that transmits sound to the human brain using electromagnetic waves. So this is my field. I've been studying this field for over 40 years. And HAARP scares me because I know what it can do. I know that HAARP can be used to control the human mind.
ELF, extremely low frequencies affecting mental states of individuals, is not new. It goes back to Yale University and the work of Jose Delgado, which is well recognized in the literature. He started first using implants in the brain. He then used radio frequency with implants, and eventually found that energy at 1/50th of what the Earth naturally that produces could, in fact, in certain frequency ranges, trigger huge mood swings. This document from Maxwell Air Force Base lays out the use of electromagnetic weapon technologies for debilitating human beings.
And that's just a little clip of Harp, Holes in Heaven, and all that information is up there for you to check out. I'm going to close out the show with a couple of obituaries, one old and one new. The new one, first, is Philip Agee, former CIA agent, dead at 72 in Cuba. Dateline Havana, this coming from the Associated Press. Renegade former CIA agent Philip Agee, whose naming of agency operatives helped prompt a new U.S. law against exposing government spies, has died in Cuba, his wife said Wednesday. He was 72. Agee quit the CIA in 1969 after 12 years working mostly in Latin America at a time when leftist movements were gaining prominence and sympathizers. His 1975 book, Inside the Company, CIA Diary, cited alleged misdeeds against leftists in the region and included a 22-page list of purported agency operatives. The list created an uproar around the world and helped prompt Congress to pass a law against naming clandestine U.S. agents abroad. It also led the State Department to strip Agee of his U.S. passport. Vince Canestrero, a former CIA counterterrorism chief, said Agee's book was considered a very serious blow to CIA's clandestine operations. It had a major impact, and some people had to be pulled out.
Well, Philip Agee joins us now from Cuba. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't we start off with Larry Johnson's comment with what the Bushes alleged and your response to this whole scandal that is brewing in Washington.
Well, Mr. Johnson is repeating a story put about by the CIA, beginning with the Welch assassination in Athens in 1975. From the moment of that event, the CIA tried to put the blame on me, because at that time I was involved with quite a lot of other people in a guerrilla journalism campaign to expose the CIA's operations and its people, especially in Western Europe at that time. George Bush's father came in as CIA director the month following the Welch assassination. And as director, he presided over the agency as they mounted a campaign throughout Western Europe, trying to make me appear to be a security threat, a traitor, a Soviet agent, a Cuban agent, all those sorts of things, which led to my expulsion from five different NATO countries in the late 1970s. In fact, it was all based on lies. And to think that I was responsible for the death of any CIA people for their exposures is absolutely false, because no one, as far as I know, of all those people who were exposed as CIA people along with their operations, was ever even harassed or threatened. What happened was their operations were disrupted, and that was the purpose of what we were doing. And we were right to do it then, because the U.S. policy at the time, executed by the CIA, was to support murderous dictatorships around the world, as in Vietnam, as in Greece, as in Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and that's only to name a few. And we opposed that use of the U.S. intelligence service for those dirty operations. And I'm talking about regimes now that tortured and disappeared people by the thousands.
That's Philip Agee on an interview on Democracy Now! Going all the way back to October 2nd, 2003, as, of course, the Valerie Plame scandal was breaking. So you got different kinds of CIA exposure retaliation from one side to the other. The other obituary, I've kind of run out of time to cover, but I'd had it in my drafts. I'd never posted it up on the page. It had always just kind of been sitting there. But I've always been interested in the story of Danny Casolaro and the octopus and the Inslaw affair and all that. There is a Unsolved Mysteries video that someone's posted up, and it's posted up on MediaMonarchy.com. You can see their story about the suicide, quote-unquote, of Joseph Daniel Casolaro. Died August 10th, 1991. He was an American freelance journalist. Casolaro was found dead in a bathtub in the Sheridan Inn in Martinsburg, West Virginia, one day after allegedly arranging to meet a source in connection with an investigation he had referred to as the Octopus. His research centered around a complex story called the Inslaw Affair, I-N-S-L-A-W, and a sprawling conspiracy theory supposedly connected to it. Government officials twice ruled that Casolaro's death was a suicide. However, within days of his death, family and friends were arguing that he had been killed or suicided. Gary Lee of the Washington Post wrote, quote, "Friends and relatives strongly suspect foul play, though they presented no evidence of it. They cited what they called the strange coincidence of Casolaro's death and his investigation of the Inslaw case." Now, of course, he even told his brother previously, "Hey, if I die, I didn't do it." And I also have linked up, and I read last year the book The Octopus about Danny Casolaro and the secret government, written by the also suicided Jim Keefe and also Ken Thomas. So all that's up there about Danny Casolaro and the Octopus up on MediaMonarchy.com. So that's going to do it. So lastly, let me just mention some of the spooky spooks that visit MediaMonarchy.com through the week. First, we've got Iraq.centcom.mil. That's the Department of Defense Network Information Center coming out of Columbus, Ohio. They googled Iraq IHT merchants case, and that's a story out of the International Herald Tribune. The Drug Enforcement Administration was on the page three times at least. We had the headquarters of the 5th Signal Command Army visiting MediaMonarchy.com. We even had the William Wrigley Jr. Company. That's right, Wrigley's Gum, hitting MediaMonarchy.com, thanks to my link on DailyScare.com. We had the Navy, and they were on MediaMonarchy.com, reading about how they're not allowed to use their sonar in California anymore. We had the Halliburton Company. They googled, quote, "Ron Paul for the Long Haul," which is the song I played for you last week by Roy Shivers, a.k.a. Daniel Abramson. We have Rupert Murdoch and News Corporation visiting after googling Uzi Naga's New York Defender, and that's, of course, the 9/11 video game that people are in an uproar about. We had the Department of Defense Dependent School European Region Google Nazis' secret animal-human breeding projects. We had the Beale Air Force Base, the 9th Communications Squadron, they googled New York Defender, the 9/11 video game. Playboy out of Benton Harbor, Michigan, googled, or rather were reading about Mitt Romney and his private equity firm Bain Capital that are buying Clear Channel. Yes, that buyout has been approved. We had the U.S. Department of Energy coming out of Montgomery Village, Maryland. They were reading the Source Watch entry about Linton Brooks, who was fired from the nuclear head position. We covered that about a year ago on MediaMonarchy.com. And finally, this morning, the U.S. courts out of Brooklyn, New York, googled, and this is nice, if you Google January 10th Fox debate South Carolina video, I get a higher hit than Fox News itself does. So thank you for that, and thank you for listening, and I enjoy doing it for you every week. Coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info, I implore you to hit me up with MySpace or Yahoo or Facebook or Dig or YouTube and any of that with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And the podcast available anytime thanks to radioforall.net and archive.org. That's going to do it. And yes, it's been another interesting week, and we're just getting started on 2008. It's only going to get hairier, and I will be here for you, giving you the best kind of news I know how to do here on MediaMonarchy.com. So my name's James. Once again, let me say thank you for listening. And like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.